The Marion Finucane Show on RTE Radio 1 with Ireland's savings specialists. Rabodirect, the straight-talking savings bank. The Marion Finucane Show on RTE Radio 1 with Ireland's savings specialists. Rabodirect, the straight-talking savings bank.
Hello there, and a very good morning to you. You're very welcome indeed to the programme this morning. Last one before the big day, so to speak. We'll start this morning with the Irish Mail on Sunday. Life support woman's brain scan delayed. The injury happened after a crucial test was postponed. The Sunday Independent, no light but darkness visible. Maria Cahill's, that's a kind of a play on things because they also have a picture also of Newgrange, this being the Winter Solstice and all of that. Anyway, they say Maria Cahill scandal rocks Sinn Féin. Two-thirds don't believe Adams. Half say Mary Lou's damaged. Independence to dominate the Dáil, and that's based on a poll. There are polls. The papers are coming down with polls this weekend. The Sunday Business Post exclusive hidden waiting list. This is a story that will put the fear of God in people, I'm afraid, about the HSE omits tens of thousands of patients from official figures. And there's a long story inside by Susan Mitchell on the kinds of appointments that people can't get, and they really are worrying. They have a picture of Sean Quinn there. Apparently he's back in business and returning to his former empire. 10,000 in line for payouts from RSA and a 200 million bonanza for Aer Lingus staff if IAG bid succeeds. And I know there was a big row going on out there about pensions, but apparently there will be a nice little sum. Most of the airline staff hold shares worth more than 47,000 each. So if the deal goes ahead, and they reckon IAG is going to make another offer, and they reckon that maybe it might be accepted, so they'll be in for a bit of a windfall. Sunday Times, hospital has right to end life support. And that goes into the pros and cons of who has the right and who plays God and who makes decisions and all that kind of thing. Labour slumps to 5%. Labour has slumped to an all-time low, and Sinn Féin has reached a new peak in the latest behaviour and attitudes opinion polls for the Sunday Times, and Coveney says no abortion poll. Now, the Sunday World has a story about a wife visiting her husband who was convicted of abuse. We have the Sunday Mirror, Mel B, my marriage is over. And the Irish Sun on Sunday, Gilligan rage address. That's another story about John Gilligan. My God, he has contributed to more print than many a person, shall we say. Now, let me introduce our guest to you. With us this morning, David Sweeney, who's managing editor of NPR, that's National Public Radio, in the United States, based in Washington. Colm O'Regan, comedian, contributor to the BBC World Service and the Irish Examiner. Kathy Kelly, writer and UNICEF ambassador, just back from visit to Jordan, to a refugee camp on Jordan's Syrian border. Niamh Lyons, Paul Corr with the Irish Daily Mail, and Eddie Malloy, management consultant, chairman of Mental Health Reform, and you are all very welcome indeed. Since it's so prevalent in the news and in all the world news, more or less at the moment, David, just very briefly, that the shooting of those two policemen in Brooklyn, this is all snowballing from Ferguson, is it?
Good morning, Marion. Yes, I mean, nasty business. Two policemen shot dead by a gunman who apparently had shot his girlfriend earlier in the day, drove up to New York. He had posted on social media that he was planning to target policemen because he was upset about the grand juries refusing to indict policemen for, you know, for killing a couple of black men. Unfortunately, the warnings from the police in Maryland did not reach the police in New York in time. So, I mean, this sort of plays into the current, you know, dynamics in the States around race, around, you know, sort of economic disparities, social disparities. And, you know, I think it's an unfortunate, you know, manifestation of some of the, you know, sort of darker sides of, you know, where people just sort of go to a very dark place and see that they want to act out.
Racism really has never been eradicated in the States. Like somebody was saying that it's still one of the most racist countries in the world.
I mean, there's an interesting poll out, I think, this weekend by one of the big polling organizations that says that 11 or 12% of Americans now view racism in the country as the biggest issue, above the economy, above various other, you know, healthcare and various other issues, which I think is certainly interesting. I mean, I think the issue of race and, you know, particularly racial disparity, you know, in terms of treatment of minorities by police officers, you know, in some communities where the communities are, you know, predominantly minority, whether it be Hispanic or Black, and the police force is predominantly white, they're seen as...
Why is it still predominantly white?
There are a number of, you know, I think it's hard to generalize in terms of, you know, on a sort of broad across the country, given that it's so big. But I think in some communities, in some of the smaller communities where, you know, in the South and in, you know, even in Ferguson, which is in the Midwest, you know, that the sort of the centers of the levers of power are still held by, you know, white. And that is, there are any number of reasons for that. I mean, there's, you know, part of it is, you know, electoral districts, the way they're drawn to, you know, to benefit, you know, particular politicians and particular
parties.
You're
talking gerrymandering.
Yes, there's a fair degree of gerrymandering.
Yeah.
I mean, that is an acknowledged issue. It's also, you know, when you've got, you know, turnout among, you know, minorities is not... Isn't the most sort of the highest levels?
Yeah.
So there are any number of issues that play into this, and I think it's one of those sort of societal issues that is, it was very hard to, you know, deal with. I think it's, you know, and as I say, the issues over the summer with from Ferguson, from Staten Island.
Yeah.
Now it's sort of it's back percolating. It never went away, but it's back again. Front
right.
and centre in terms of politics.
Okay, we'll just stick slightly with America for the beginning here. Kathy, you looked at the Sony cyber attack.
Yeah, it's a very bizarre story, this. Apparently everyone in Hollywood is frantically getting rid of all their emails. We should all get rid of all our emails, apparently.
I don't think you can.
Well, no, you can't, absolutely, but they're rather frantically. And I'm hearing here that, you know, you can look for emails where you say rude words about other people and you can go through them. Look at it from the point of view of even on your Kindle, they can work out how much of a book you've read. The new Donna Tartt book, apparently, despite selling vast amounts, people have only read 40% of it. So basically, in the cyber world, nothing is safe. So this situation with North Korea, President Obama coming out saying that he wants China to step in and try and help find out if it is the North Koreans who have somehow amazingly hacked into the Sony and let all their information free, and this film, The Interview, is now being totally shelved at a loss of $90 million.
But I presume when it is released, undoubtedly it will be, it'll have had the best publicity of any movie ever made in the history of Christendom.
Absolutely. But the thing that astonishes me is this is a country where outside, you know, the capital, this is North Korea, outside the capital, the people are starving, where we have had so many recent political prisoners escape to talk about people held in cages in prisons. And yet somehow the thing that is inciting President Obama to talk, and I'm a fan of President Obama, but he's talking about, you know, about a movie. I'm sorry, I just find this something slightly weird here from a human rights point of view.
It's
like a movie within a movie.
Yeah.
Because the actual plot itself of what happened, this, that a country would prevent the release of probably a fairly mainstream iffy movie, that watching it now will probably be an act of freedom to watch it. Like, it's the best thing that ever happened, probably was a very generic film. And it's Anything with North Korea is always placed in this comic area as if it's a cartoon, but it's not. As Kathy says, it's a real. Yeah. There's real people are in trouble there. I just find it strange that it would be North Korea. I remember North Korea last year sent a nuclear threat to South Korea via a fax from a car. Now to think that they have the capability to bring down an entire like Sony's internet or email network. Sounds a bit ludicrous.
You have a question mark in your head about
I also think that people want to believe that the baddie is identifiable and has a shape, and it's a North Korean shape, whereas the other alternative is that it's anarchic. It's like Al-Qaeda. It's without a leader. It's all of these self-operating nodes all over. So people want to believe that it might be North Korea, which gives them this target. And I think we were talking about it earlier, Obama talking about a response to North Korea. What's he going to do? Like, take down their email? I'm sure what he'll find in their email is a load of nothing.
He's already got all of our emails.
Exactly.
Yeah. Indeed, yeah.
And it makes you really nervous because, like, you actually think, when you're actually writing an email, how would this look if it somehow escaped out into the ether? You have to be very bland, I think, in emails now, because once you type it and press send, you've lost control of it.
Absolutely.
It's stored on a server somewhere in Hungary or in Ireland or in Minnesota. You've no control over it, so it really does.
I think I've said it before, but I remember way back somebody giving me the definition of an email is something which you send out to possibly anyone or everyone in the world, but you hope also particularly the name that you've sent it to.
George Clooney comes out of it quite nicely, though, because he was just very anxious about the bad reviews for Monuments Men, and instead of throwing a queenie fit, he said something like, "I'm really sorry, and I'm so ashamed, and I'll do next time, and it'll make more money for you." You see,
well, he went
decent
man to all the studios with a petition, asking the studios to club together on this. Now, no one would sign it. It shows the kind of closed shop that Hollywood is, if we didn't know that already. But the other interesting part is, I don't know the guy's name, but the president of Sony had to kind of remind President Obama that the studios don't control the movie theatres.
I know, yeah.
So this is the reason why we're not seeing it. Because, and frankly, I mean, who goes to the cinema on Christmas Day? But that's probably another point. But, I mean,
a lot of people would if they had a choice.
Probably. But, I mean, the idea as well that this movie is about the North Koreans. Is that how they're making this link, or is there something more sophisticated to tell them?
Well, apparently the leader gets blown up in a very particularly nasty way.
But our experience of hackers would be that it's normally a guy in a dressing gown in an apartment in like Sheboygan, Idaho. It's never the people we think that it is.
Yeah.
You know, and the idea as well that the North Koreans, the way they're even educating their people, you know, do they have the manpower? Do they have the technology? Do they have, there's certainly no external expertise coming in telling them best practice and how to do things.
I say Angelina Jolie wasn't overly pleased.
Yeah, she doesn't come out of it very well.
She sure
does she?
Doesn't, yeah. No. Anyway, there are a number of people that don't come out of things too well at all today either, and that is the polls here in Ireland. Had a look at those, Niamh, didn't you?
Yeah, well, I suppose it could be the solidification of negativity back towards the government in terms of water. And I suppose water is seen now as being the tipping point for the government. And I suppose they must be going into their Christmas holidays wondering where it all went so wrong for them this year, because they started the year coming out of the bailout programme and had quite an impressive kind of media foray for a little while anyway. And then
perhaps
just went from
foolishly.
Bad to worse. Possibly. They were criticised at the time that they made too much of a big deal of it, that shouldn't necessarily have been celebrated until we saw some semblance of growth or whatever. But I suppose the sad thing that you see from the polls, I mean, apart from the fact that, you know, trying to cobble together a government looks like an impossibility from the figures, so, unless you have some kind of grand coalition, which I don't know would work in this country.
Well, I just don't know if you go through the figures how you would do them. I was trying to figure out how you would do the combinations and permutations this morning. Let me go, if I may, on the phone to Adrian Kavanagh, who's lecturer in geography in Maynooth University, and he has done a lot of work on it today, and it's up on his website. Just give us, first of all, good morning, Adrian, and thanks for taking
morning,
our
Marian.
Call. Go through the figures as you figured they would be based on these polls.
Yeah. Last night was almost like is basically a Super Tuesday of polls, with three polls all coming out at the same time.
Yeah.
What's interesting is the figures aren't that dissimilar to each other. On these figures, looking at the polls, you'd have The Independents and Others grouping winning something between 40 and 50 seats. Fine Gael probably winning a number of seats in the low 40s. Sinn Féin winning between the mid-30s and the low 40s. Fianna Fáil in the low 30s. And Labour, on these figures, wouldn't be winning anything.
Zero.
They'd be on zero. Now, this is just looking at the numbers. In the election, they might be able to cobble together a few seats if they got lucky in terms of maybe the Independents and Others both being
transfers
spread out between
and that
too
sort
many
of
candidates,
thing.
Transfers. But you're looking really at only at a handful of constituencies, say Dublin South Central, Dublin Bay South, Dublin Fingal, Wexford, Carlow, Kilkenny, Cork East, where they would be really competitive. On these figures, you're looking really at best at a handful of TDs for Labour.
But yeah, it's very interesting that you say, well, the polls are usually first preferences, aren't they? They don't go through them.
They are, yeah,
but on the
yeah,
first preferences, zero, that is an absolute disaster.
There's no sign of a Burton bounce there. And I think Labour must really be scratching their heads now and wondering if the, you know, jettisoning Eamon Gilmore when they did, coming out of a bad local elections, was the right timing for that at all? Because, you know, if a change in leadership was supposed to, you know, bring a new level of understanding and, I suppose, cohesion within the Labour Party, it simply hasn't.
Eddie?
Yeah, the Sunday Independent, the editorial and Brendan O'Connor are really saying that this is a very serious matter.
Yeah,
and the editorial says that it's an existential crisis for the state. Now, I don't think that's an overstatement, because if I link it up with something Conor Brady said in the Sunday Times about referring to the banking inquiry, is we need to understand what is it about us that leaves us time and again screwing up, taking the banking and the economic situation.
Yeah.
Now, the idea of 50 independents, all of whom have a single issue, and are presenting a scenario which is really misleading. I mean, the independents and the hard left are misleading people. For example, bringing an end to austerity is to mislead people. There is no end to paying back the debt, personal and national debt. So I think it's extremely serious that the government has so lost the trust of people.
Yeah. The main parties have, you know.
Yeah.
Micheál Martin comes out reason top
he
in
does,
terms
yeah.
of personal
so,
popularity.
So, I mean, you know, we talk about ourselves as a sophisticated electorate. If our sophisticated electorate were to totally abandon almost the party political system in voting in and vote in 50, our sophisticated electorate would get what they voted for, if you follow
me.
Well,
if you look at how people will be voting and why they'll be voting, you know, beforehand, the reason there's such a large majority in the Dáil now is because there was an element of social cohesion in the run-up to 2011, because everybody felt broke. Nobody knew what to do.
And there was frightened.
And there was a level of confusion among among people about where society was going. Now, in the next general election, people are looking back into their pockets. And Pat Leahy actually has a very good line in his piece in the Sunday Business Post today. The fact is that a huge segment of the population, 60% in today's poll, sees little or no impact of the recovery in their own daily lives. So people are going to the polls next time out saying, what have you done for me? So if you're a Magdalen survivor, if you're somebody in mortgage arrears, if you're somebody who's in negative equity, or even if you just simply have held your job the whole time and, you know, you've been working
treading
away,
water.
Keeping the
yeah,
head down.
Yeah.
So you're looking at an independent this time and you're asking them, well, what exactly can you do to me for me if you all band together with one another? And the fact is that anybody who makes a promise in the next general election will live or die by it. Because what we saw very clearly was that the Labour Party are as low as they are because of promises broken. Nobody needed to tell fibs in 2011. Nobody needed to tell anybody that there wasn't going to be cuts in child benefit. Pensioners wouldn't face any cuts, that people weren't going to have water charges. Fine Gael put it into their manifesto that they would do all of those things. Mm. They're enjoying, you know, a little bit more support from their core group, you know, than Labour are for that very reason. But the fact is, Labour at 6% hasn't massively slipped from their core vote. They're usually nationally about 10, 11, 12%. Mm. So the fact that, you know, the elements working against them here, and Adrian probably knows more about this than me, are bonus seats and losing out heavily to people on the left.
Right. The other thing, I'd love you to take that point up, Adrian, but also in one of the paper's coverages, I think it was the Business Post, that it seemed that the major support for independence was coming from what are called the ABC One group. Are you there, Adrian?
Oh, yeah, sorry, yeah.
Yeah?
No, that's the first. That's interesting because if you look at most of the trends in actual elections, the major swing against the government parties and also Fianna Fáil to a lesser extent has come from the lower middle-class, working-class groups. So that's an interesting trend. I don't know if that would really transfer an election, but if that's the case, it might suggest that there is an audience out there for a new grouping on the right, maybe based around the Reform Alliance or the proposed new Independent Alliance.
Yeah, and I see Michael McDool writing about it, and indeed Shane Ross. Colm, you wanted to come in on
it. Well, just listening to some of the commentary about existential threat to the state, I mean, these are the voters. Like, they're not a rampaging horde of idiots. Like, they have the right to make a choice and choose their candidates, and presumably there's a difference. First of all, there's a difference between asked on the doorstep, who would you vote for? And your first answer is, well, not that shower anyway.
Yeah.
And then who else? Because obviously independents in this group are a lumpen group of, would you vote for a group known as the independents as opposed to a particular candidate? So I don't know whether there's just this notion of fear of the electorate as if they're not capable of making some sort of decision around who they'd like to govern.
Well, the electorate does make very bizarre decisions from time to time.
I mean, I think there are two, 65% in one of the poll figures, 65% of people don't have confidence that Labour and Fine Gael can manage the economy, which is very interesting. And I think there are two sets of reasons for that. One is there's a large number of people, that ABC figure you just gave,
yes,
who believe that the government is not governing, that they're caving in, they're backing off, and they're prepared to throw money at anything. They ignored the advice of the Fiscal Council, the IMF. In other words, that the government is falling into exactly the same trap
as the previous government.
And Rob Wright's evidence before the banking inquiry was very interesting because he essentially took the opportunity to say to the politicians in his presence, I hope you guys don't screw up again.
And if the banking inquiry is worth anything from a message, right, it's going to be,
yeah,
here's how to
now,
govern.
Yeah. And going back to Niamh's point about people will live or die by the promises of it,
yeah,
it won't stop independents making the promises and people being taken in by the promises. And that's why there is a gullibility there that I think the media have a role in to educate people or explain to people what the dangers are of going for the kind of chaos
that we could have. Cathy, you want to come in?
I just wanted to say, look, I mean, how many times did Bertie Ahern get in, and look where that brought us. So, yeah, people do dumb things.
But I suppose they vote for their local candidates when the structures of the big parties have been broken down. You know, you end up getting Fianna Fáil whether you wanted it or not, or you end up getting Fine Gael. So maybe when there's a more fractious political scene, there might be more choice.
Like, I don't think they deserve to get back in. Do you follow me? The current shower. Okay. But the question is, what is the alternative?
Well, as you look at those figures given to us by Adrian, now I had taken out other ones that said independence 50, well, like he was saying between this and this. So independence 54, Sinn Féin 32, Fine Gael 41, Fianna Fáil 31, and Labour 0. Where's the government there?
And would Sinn Féin take power with a hodgepodge group of independents that they can't control? I mean, the discipline within Sinn Féin is undoubtedly their strongest asset as a party because, as we've seen with the Murray O'Cahill affair,
they circle
the wagons.
Yeah.
And I suppose in Sinn Féin in particular, you don't see acts of disobedience within the parliamentary party, and they all vote together, they all club together in issues, and the spectre of having to manage and control so many different individual personalities seems to me not something that they'd go for.
Mm. I think two largest parties, whoever they are, will go into coalition together regardless of their ideology and they'll make a deal. Mm.
But if you take the two largest there, it would be Fine Gael and Sinn Féin, but they wouldn't have a majority.
how far off are they? They'll grab one of their...
I suppose you can't forget the likes of the kind of right-wing support from that's forming now within the independents, the likes of Lucinda Creighton's grouping. You know, we don't have a Reform Alliance party, as it were, but certainly I think... I suppose maybe she might say hell would have to freeze over before she would do a deal with Enda Kenny again.
Hell freezes over an awful lot in Irish politics.
People are agreeing programme for governments. And I mean, obviously she would be a much easier bedfellow for someone like Enda Kenny, despite their differences, along with perhaps Shane Ross, Peter Matthews, Terence Flanagan, if he's still outside the fold in the run-up to the next general election, than doing business, say, with, you know, your Michael Fitzmaurice's or your Richard Boyd Barrett's or whoever else gets in on that side.
Well, I mean, I presume, as far as the politicians are concerned, there is a long way to go. But yep. A year can gallop by fairly quickly. Listen, thank you very much indeed for talking to us, Adrian Kavanagh. And the other thing that I was going to, kind of in the same vein, the news about George Redmond.
Yeah, what struck me about the news about George Redmond, just as George Redmond and everybody else is getting off the hook.
Just to explain to the audience what happened with George Redmond.
What happened with George Redmond was that there was what was called explosive evidence in the hands of the tribunal, which was not given to Joseph Murphy's defence. And Joseph Murphy was vindicated and the tribunal was found not to have provided that explosive evidence, which right. would have, if you like, been to Joseph Murphy's advantage. And George Redmond took a case then based on his, and if, in other words, if the tribunal had misbehaved in relation to Joseph Murphy, therefore the tribunal's credentials were damaged goods. And George Redmond essentially got off. And George Redmond, his all copies of the report that have George Redmond's name in it are being removed from public libraries. It's been taken off the internet, and he is a free man and he will get his costs. And that's likely to lead to a surge from others who can similarly claim that the tribunal didn't play fair and seek their own costs back. The irony for me in this and the timing of it is just as all of that, the tribunal and the years and years and millions of it is falling and more money to pay these people's costs, we have the start of a banking inquiry 10 years after the event or whatever, 6 years after the event. And you really have to ask questions about certainly nobody in the banking inquiry can ever fear the hand of the law.
I mean, you were saying we're not all a bunch of idiots, but I have to say, Colm, that from time to time you have to query that statement in the first place. I mean, how 15 years was it for that particular tribunal? And millions and millions and millions and millions and millions of our money spent on it.
It's depressing. And I was just thinking, I would love to have been at the banking inquiry at that moment when Mr. Nyberg said, this isn't going to achieve anything. I would have seen them all exchange glances around the table going, what are we doing here? The problem with all of these tribunals, and they're so toothless, is that in them, probably in the banking inquiry, there doesn't seem to be any disincentive to further wrongdoing later on. That nobody in anybody with a decent lawyer who's contemplating some sort of chicanery will say, Asher, there might be a tribunal, but I'll be grand. Like, just a kind of an anecdote, do a lot of stuff down in Kilkenomics, and there's a guy there called Bill Black who was famous for investigating the savings and loan scandal in the United States in the mid-80s, and he jailed 1,000 bankers. Like, he put them in jail. And he was so dangerous to the establishment that he actually had to be given protection. But he was talking about the only time that all of these people, the hard necks, he ever sees them broken is when they're actually convicted and they realise they're going to jail.
Right.
And that is the disincentive. Now, I'm not saying that applies in any of these tribunals, but there is no fear of any...
of consequences.
Because they're either toothless or they know that a good lawyer and enough loopholes, and there's bound to be a paperwork mistake.
Well, the fear in this instance was those people having to write very large cheques. But the others that Eddie refers to that who may now have a case to go back and seek costs are Ray Burke, 10 million. Bertie Ahern, over a million. Poor Flynn. So the issue here... is the spectre of the state now having to pay out even more money in tribunals. And I mean, if we're honest about it, and this could be the other problem with the banking inquiry, do we actually know anything from the billion or so that we've spent on all of our tribunals in this country?
It's very little. You do that rather well in the States. I mean, why is it so good in the States, David?
I mean, I think there's two things. One is, I think, you know, in terms of the remits of the, you know, the parliamentary or congressional inquiries. I mean, in the US, the, you know, Congress has pretty broad powers, and they tend to give themselves pretty broad powers when it comes to when some, you know, topic, you know, banking, you know, crisis, wherever comes along and they decide, well, we're going to investigate. They have pretty broad, you know, remit, so they can go and ask the tough questions, and they do, you know, bring witnesses. They compel witnesses to come.
Can I ask you a question? Do the politicians there tend to use it to grandstand, to make political gain for themselves?
Absolutely.
They do?
Absolutely. I mean, there's, you know, as good as some of the congressional inquiries are in terms of turning up, impress us no end. And, you know, in terms of having the resources of, you know, big congressional staff to go and investigate and, you know, have the subpoena power to, you know, compel people to, you know, give documents. And, you know, so the staffs work really hard. They have, you know, they have terrific resources to bring in all the facts. And then, you know, listen, I've never met a politician who didn't like grandstanding. And, you know, there, some of them may have valid points, but they will stand on, you know, their points for their own benefit. And the other part of it is that...
You see, that's why I think the people in Ireland voted against it in the referendum, because they didn't actually trust the politicians.
The other sort of part of this is that the federal, you know, accountability boards, or, you know, sort of the SEC, the Securities and Exchange Commission, the new consumer kind of federal regulatory body, these bodies all have enormous powers. They have, you know, greater powers than I believe than they have here in Ireland in terms of power of subpoena, power of prosecution.
They can kick in doors.
And, you know, the number of times when you see, you know, alleged miscreants doing the perp walk, you know, and, you know, you never want to be seen doing a perp walk. I mean, you know.
I think that's pretty awful.
It is pretty awful, but it's a powerful incentive or disincentive to, you know, either, you know, come to a deal with prosecuting authorities. I mean, the prosecutors have a lot of power. You know, some of that goes to the, you know, some degree of prosecutorial overreach sometimes. But I think there is a difference in that, is there a really strong mandate? I mean, in, you know, the US, there's Americans' constitutional makeup is to sort of see that right is done. I mean, you can argue around, you know, argue around that, but, you know, you do something wrong, you should be penalised.
Is some of it to do with the size of Ireland, that we all know each other? Like, to paraphrase Ard Lohanlon, you know, how could you put hard questions to somebody in the afternoon that you were playing golf with in the morning? You know, is that some of the problem?
Meeting in the canteen, like elbow to elbow as you're leaning over to put your coleslaw on your plate. I mean, I can't say that TDs this week in the banking inquiry were grandstanding per se, but you certainly did see quite a few loaded questions going in, and questions that were heavily kind of sentimental based on their own personal views about things. And Ciarán Lynch was quite good at kind of pulling them back and also saying, you know, everybody's kind of on the clock. And there tends to be lead questioners on each occasion. And Ciarán Lynch will constantly remind them, you have to ask your question, but you have to leave the person enough time to answer it. You know, so you have these big, long, kind of paragraph-style questions that hit three or four points, but don't kind of get down to the nub of something. And in both cases this week, kind of left the person answering the questions quite confused as to what the point being made was.
What
about freedom of information in the States? Because we were talking about this earlier, about how nobody writes anything down in a department. We're looking at, you know, culpability or how you can actually be held responsible. So here, nobody's writing anything down in case freedom of information gets that email out there, and we're trying not to embarrass a minister or screw up or show our lack of ability in some cases.
Yeah.
Well, what's the situation then in the States? Is that a similar thing?
No, it's not something that I have come across or that I've noticed. I mean, I think there is a greater, I mean, there's a sort of a constitutional right to freedom of information in the sense of, you know, media organizations can file requests. Congress will file requests. You know, there are plenty of government agencies that will file, you know, for information. So there's a very strong, you know, sort of mandate in terms of pulling information out. Right. And, you know, and in terms of government,
yeah,
in terms
sure.
of
yeah,
giving written advice.
The other big difference to the States is the speed at which it works.
Yeah.
I mean, we're 10 years on. I mean, people have died and so on in a lot of these cases. I mean, there are three things. I've been reading a book by a political philosopher, a very esteemed one, in Political Order and Decay. He said there are three things for a well-functioning state. Technocratic competence, that's the competence of people in places like the central bank and the department. We have questions answered on that. The second one is the rule of law. The rule of law does not apply here. And the third one is accountability. And we have huge problems in relation
here.
To those. Yeah. You know?
That the evidence given, or the contribution made, I should say, I suppose, by the Canadian this week, he was touching on your old hobby horse, which
That's
is
right.
what Cathy was talking yeah. about as well, which is the advice given to ministers, yeah. the relationship between the minister and the civil service, and the way we've structured it, it sometimes seems nobody has to answer
well,
to anybody.
I've been reading the Toland Review of the Department of Justice, and if you haven't read it, you should read it, because it's absolutely jaw-dropping incompetence and mismanagement from start to finish today in the Department of Justice. Now, going back to the Department of Finance, if you don't have the competence, you won't have the confidence to challenge. And what the culture in the Department of Finance was, it accepted incompetence, the gifted generalists that I've talked about, and also what I would say is ingratiation. The civil servants ingratiating themselves with the politicians, not taking notes. I remember Gareth Fitzgerald saying it should be illegal not to take notes. Mm-hmm. And the fear there is that they're protecting both the ministers
and themselves.
And so you have this Faustian pact between the two of them.
Other thing that I would have thought about civil servants and the kind of caution of some civil servants was that you might take notes to watch your back.
But could I say, sorry to interrupt you, Marion.
Yeah.
There's a very good example during the week of a civil servant speaking up, and that was Niamh Donoghue, the Secretary General for Social Protection, who put it on the record several times that the PPS number should not go to Irish Water. That's on the record, and it was released recently. And she was overridden by either her own minister or somebody else. So we now know, we've a glimpse through that,
yeah.
into that space
yeah.
now. So it isn't that all civil servants do it. It can happen in departments where a particular culture develops, like in finance and in justice, where it's just unbelievable, the lack of qualified people. And Rob Wright again commented on that last week. He said, you still don't have enough people qualified in economics.
I heard Michael Noonan sounding very defensive about
yeah,
that.
He was.
Dismissive,
yeah.
in fact.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
What do you think, Colm? I mean, you dabble in both sides if you, in terms of economics.
Well, I suppose in terms of, I wonder, is it a feature of organisations that as organisations age, like we're all in love with the tech organisations. They're so free and clear and everything is so transparent. But as organisations age, you know, broadcasters as well, you know, and civil service, you know, certain patterns form, and in terms of promotion in the civil service, it's about longevity, it's about good relationships. You know, how many people from externally go into at the highest levels? It's only recently happening. So we have yet to see the result of that culture.
And that was within the Gardaí as well, because presumably if you disagreed with the culture, you wouldn't get promotion.
And particularly in something with the Gardaí, you can understand how loyalty is really important, because for them, it's out there is far more dangerous to them than in here, you know, when you think of the people that they're actually doing battle with on a daily basis. So I suppose we do kind of say civil servants as a generic group, but within organisations, things, you know, relationships develop.
Yeah.
And if there aren't new brooms, what's missing is, like, talking about the Toland report, I read the PPARS report 10 years ago. It's the same thing. Mm-hmm. The same thing about lack of accountability, lack of ability to measure progress. That was in the area of a computer system. But
yeah.
it was the same thing. And again, no, you know, nobody wants to be hung out to dry, but sometimes you know, you do a job and you get paid at the highest levels in the civil service, six figures, and your pension, which works out at a huge amount, there has to be consequences for if you don't do your job. And thus far, we don't really see, like, ministers lose their job because of incompetence or they resign. But civil servants, it doesn't really happen. And I'm not targeting the front line or anything. I'm talking about people who get paid 150 grand a year or in some cases 200 grand. If they mess up, we never see the consequences of the mistake, be it...
I suppose the consequences of a mistake for them might be that it stunts their line of being able to move up in the ranks within a department. Say, for instance, I do FOIs, it's part of my job. And if I find a document, you know, with the SecGen of the Department of Finance telling the Minister for Finance, Minister, you shouldn't have said we're going to, you know, get rid of stamp duty in the next general election, I don't think that's advisable. Our advice is that we can't afford to do that. You know, one of the things that came out very clearly in the Bank Inquiry, particularly from Rob Wright, the Canadian, was that it's the clamour. It's not in the writing of that article that critiques the situation. It's then the clamour from the opposition parties and the government and the kind of, you know, row that then takes place between the two that forces the issue. You know, an opposition party saying, well, an opposition party saying, well, why don't you get rid of stamp duty? Surely you can find the money to do it somehow. And the government going, God, we're going to have to do this now because they've brought the issue onto the agenda. And our advice says that we shouldn't. Politically, it has to be done. Financially, it can't be done, but there's a general election to be won.
I mean, just to both Eddie and Colm's, you know, points of sort of lack of sort of technical ability and accountability. I'm just, you know, curious about, you know, go back to the opinion polls and, you know, the support for the independents for sort of broad sort of homogenous group in one way. But is that, does that sort of beg a question about the sort of a breakdown of the social contract in the sense of, you know, you're looking at people saying, well, you know, no accountability, no quality, and yet who do I have to vote for? I'm going, you know, there's a damage to the social contract.
Yeah, I mean, one of the problems for the government is that if you take the George Redmond, the collapse of the George Redmond judgment, that will fall on the government's head as well. Because it's another example of the institutions of the state, the rule of law, not applying. And the government will take that hit as well, I believe. So it really is like a blight on all your houses.
Yeah.
It's a
Mind
very
you, that's
serious
a bit
situation.
Unfair.
It is unfair.
On the government.
No, I'm not saying it's fair.
Yeah.
But when people read that, they say, Jesus, you know, another example
mess.
Of this, another mess, you know?
Yeah.
Well, a good example, actually, as usual, Jean Kerrigan kind of hits the nail on the head about issues. Oh. There's a fantastic piece comparing the Louise O'Keefe case to the Maria Cahill case and how that was dealt with by government. And Louise O'Keefe has spent, you know, decades campaigning for truth and justice in her situation. I have to say, I put in a phone call myself into government after Louise O'Keefe met with the Taoiseach.
Yeah.
And I was told, well, we're not going to be commenting on that. And that surprised me because the Taoiseach himself had been very outspoken about another woman who was abused, Maria Cahill.
Yeah.
And what Kerrigan says about it is that there isn't a red cent that has to be paid out to Maria Cahill. But all of a sudden they're having to come up with a monetary figure to basically appease. I hope if Louise O'Keefe was reading it or listening to this, that she wouldn't think that's a bad way of putting it. But basically the situation is that there are 145 people who are more or less urged to drop their cases. And in this circumstance, about 45 of them, the government thinks, has the right possibly to about €83,000. Now, the only people within that cohort who will actually get any money is if their case is just like Louise's. If a teacher in a school, in a national school, abused a child, and if that teacher had already been complained about. So the way he puts it is, child A is abused, child B is abused, child B gets the payment, and child A can bugger off. That's the way he puts it.
That's the way he puts it, yeah. Mind you, Louise O'Keefe is no mean woman, and she has tremendous tenacity, and I don't think she's going to shut up anytime soon.
No, she more or less said that to the education minister during the week. Now, often you see in these situations, sometimes that type of figure that comes out is more or less an opening bid. But Louise herself is saying, like, forget actually fighting these court cases. The advice that's being received, the workload, the time that's being spent on all these cases, she says, you know, you could write checks to all of these people now and sort it.
Yeah, it just drives me completely insane. Actually, another issue, looking at the polls and looking at Sinn Féin, and that we see a certain damage because of the Maria Cahill case. But I think
not a lot.
That's what I mean. I think there should be horrendous damage because of that. I think the way, you know, this woman was abused, her abusers got away with it. It was hidden for a very long time. I think that is absolutely appalling. And yes, it's been used as a political football. And then we see Mary Lou McDonald standing up, actually when I was in Jordan, and saying, you know, let's see what we can possibly do to try and detract attention from this. I know, I'll name a few people. So, you know, let's get the Maria Cahill story off the headlines. I think the way this country deals with abuse in so many levels, we have the,
it's
as
so
you say,
potch.
The Louise, it is hodgepodge. And there's actually nothing in the paper today, although there was yesterday, about the Fiona Doyle case. And she was, you know, her father, it was ruled her father's sentence for abuse was too lenient. She's the Bray lady whose father abused her. And appallingly, her mother went to visit him the other day. But anyway, in prison. But look at what that woman went through for so long. You know, it's, I really think judges need to get some courses on how to deal with these cases.
Well, I know part of the problem is that the Court of Appeal, mm-hmm. some of the judges don't want to give a tough sentence because they don't like when the Court of Appeal reduces it.
Yeah.
Though there was an instance this week, and that was it, wasn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, that was
court,
it.
Where the Court of Appeal...
But there's almost nothing. There's nothing in the papers today. I could find absolutely nothing in the papers today about it. It's like, well, that doesn't matter. I just think that's horrendous.
It's truth to say as well, a bit like with the tribunals, this is not the government's fault. This is the state's fault. It's a historic issue.
Yeah.
But the problem is how it's all dealt with once it comes out. And like with the HSE, when we saw during the week another child got a massive payout, and one of the things that the parents said was, why did you fight us all the way?
Yes.
And I think people just don't understand, you know, the one thing that anybody wants when they come forward with this type of story is to be listened to and to be believed and to be treated with a bit of dignity.
And an apology. The amount of cases that would not have gone to court had a civilised, dignified, genuine apology been made is amazing. I can't tell you the number of people that
people
I have interviewed.
Yeah.
I know, but also it's so adversarial. And I mean, in medicine, mistakes are going to be made. It's obvious dreadful things are going to happen. But the combination of an apology and, yes, actually the reality of funds to help care for somebody who
with
is
a grave disability.
With a grave disability, which is a massive thing for the rest of their lives, that is completely vital. We should stop fighting these cases.
Okay. But I think it's like so many things. And even just down to libel, there are loads of times you'd love to say you were sorry about something. Loads of times. But you'd be slaughtered if you did, because that's regarded as incriminating.
Well, the church's first response to all things was say nothing. And because we leave ourselves open to. And it was appalling at the time, but we see it echoed down through this lawyer. Yeah, as you say nothing. We'll work out what the details are. But as soon as you say sorry, that's a legal sorry.
It's
going to cost you. But there must be a third way.
Yeah.
There must be a combination of accepting responsibility or just humanity. Let's start with humanity and we'll work out the legals. The day after.
No. Okay. Anyway, listen, I'm going to have to take a break. With us in studio this morning, Eddie Malloy, Niamh Lyons, Cathy Kelly, Colm O'Regan, David Sweeney, and we'll be back with you after this.
Podcast The Marion Finucane Show at rte.ie/radio.
The Marion Finucane Show on RTE Radio 1 with Ireland's saving specialists. Rabodirect, the straight-talking savings bank.
Welcome back to the programme. Now, we were talking there about health and so on and so forth. There are a couple of, well, there's obviously the woman who's brain dead, the story about that in the papers today. There's also the one by Susan Mitchell, an excellent article, it has to be said, in the Sunday Business Post. You had a look at that, Cathy.
Yeah, it's an incredible article. Susan Mitchell has been doing a series of articles on waiting lists, and she's, in this particular case, she's looking at how the HSE has not been publishing what she's calling the hidden waiting list for the vast majority of diagnostic tests. So these were used to be published, but they haven't been published under the current administration, which is very, very bad. So this is for tests like MRI and CT scans. And figures, you know, indicate by the HSE show 27,000 patients are waiting on an MRI scan. For example, in the Midwestern Regional Hospital, 2,000 patients have been waiting over 2 years. And these figures are escaping the waiting list because a GP if they see a patient and they think, okay, this is cancer, this needs to be dealt with, we need
quickly.
This serious scan, they have to refer the person to a hospital doctor. A hospital doctor has to, in the public system, has to then order it. But it might take a year to see a hospital doctor. So therefore, that's how it's getting hidden. And then they end up waiting another year, in which case they are needing serious, you know, medical attention or perhaps palliative care. And the problem is due to a shortage of skilled staff, namely radiographers and radiologists, not a lack of equipment. We have the equipment.
Yeah, but the equipment seems to stop at 5 o'clock in the evening.
But that's the problem. It's only been used 5 days a week in some hospitals and it's not running around the clock. They say the Faculty of Radiology has estimated that Ireland would need an additional 120 radiologists to bring us up to the EU per capita average. So that's the problem. We have a shortage of radiographers. So therefore, we have people who are, you know, on a human level, who are going through absolute agonising suffering and then developing into serious disease from which they are dying, basically, right, because they are not fitting into any list and they're waiting 2 years.
But some of those pieces of equipment are horrendously expensive, and you would have thought that by using it around the clock, or certainly over 7 days, you would reduce the overall cost of it.
And indeed, you know, people not having to have incredibly expensive, people who might need small procedures, they might, you know, ending up with massive radiation therapy, you know, huge chemotherapy, they might not need that if they're got in time. But we just don't have enough people to operate the machinery.
And that's exactly the point. The elephant in the room is that this is the result. Like this, after you've cut and cut and cut and you cut people, sure, that something has to give. And what I find interesting about that, about the numbers, when we find out the real numbers, it echoes the crime figures, that there was errors in the crime figures about 6 weeks ago, because we all have this perception that things are not great, that there's more crime, there's more burglaries. I kind of think of it as almost like the transition between Liveline and Drive Time. So somebody rings into Liveline and says things are bad. By the time it gets to Drive Time, there's a spokesperson saying, well, actually, if you look at the statistics, things are better. But now it turns out we can't trust the statistics. So maybe the person ringing into Liveline is actually representative of what's going on.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, they spend money on statistics, all right. The HSE do statistics really well and can, you know, bury anything under something that looks a bit better. But I mean, this is the year that universal health insurance kind of died a death. And I suppose it was sort of political expediency on the one hand, but also the idea that, you know, if someone isn't going to pay, you know, 60 to 100 quid for water charges, imagine them telling them that they'd have to pay a grand and a half a year for health insurance, which is kind of the type of area that people were talking about. But I suppose, yeah, it's about cuts to, you know, the service, but it's also about, you know, the level at which the state can pay for us. We're now living longer, you know, where their medicine has come on in leaps and bounds and does so every year. So how do we think we're going to pay for that? Like, should it just always be the state that coughs up in every circumstance? Or should we start thinking, you know, how do we look after ourselves from the day we're born? You know, how are kids fed in schools, in hospitals? Oliver Dunn is going in now, a Michelin-starred chef. He's been in talks with Leo Varadkar to just feed people in hospital better when they're recovering. I just think, you know, all of this talk as well of primary care centres, you know, not allowing people to go into hospital where they get infected and come out worse or don't come out at all. You know, so I just think, like, all along, we missed such an opportunity through the boom years to think like that. And now, because we've done nothing but cut the health service in the past few years, it looks like all we'll do for the next decade is try and claw back and get back to where we were 10 years ago.
Right.
It was unplanned cuts, Marion. In other words, I'm familiar with the mental health area, and there was a disproportionate loss of psychiatric nurses. I mean, I can't remember the exact percentage, but about twice the average of the rest of the health service. And those were banked as savings, do you follow me? And obviously,
yeah,
we were told that the numbers in the public service are now reduced by X.
Yeah.
And then you had the moratorium where you couldn't hire having lost people. So the whole thing was unplanned. So if you lost 100 radiologists, excuse me, the numbers showed well. In other words, it was a cut in the pay,
yeah,
and all the rest of it. And at the same time, you didn't have targeted redundancies.
And I remember a midwife being in here and saying, midwives, loads of midwives were cut and left.
That's
and
right.
So on. And, like, it's a very special skill.
It is, yeah, absolutely.
Unless you're going to stop, yeah, babies being born, yeah, do you know?
It was like, tell us the truth, tell us the bad news, and let's start from there. I mean, it was Leo Varadkar, the best thing he did was when he came in on his first day and said, lads, we're screwed. You know, he started with that from that. Instead of 2 years of pretense about things are getting... I don't... Look, just tell me what is the worst news and we'll deal with how much does it cost, how much... What's the deficit? But this massaging of figures is utterly pointless.
And it comes back to bite you. Absolutely. Anyway.
It probably... It mightn't come back to bite the person who massaged the figures. It'll come back to bite their successor or whatever.
That's but the what it means for the health of the country, and we'll say, you know, you're talking about the mental health, Eddie. Look at the appalling situation that is going on with mental health at the moment. You know, numbers of suicides... Yeah. You know, people on the streets. It's just absolutely frightening. And there's
part
nowhere
of the homeless problem is a mental health
absolutely.
Problem. Huge part of it.
Yeah, and I mean, I know because I've attended some of these meetings, the system of getting somebody who is in a bad way, may even be suicidal, to go into A&E, which is utterly confusing for them. And that's the only way they can get in to get treatment. Like it is crazy, if you will pardon the use of the word.
There's nowhere for people to go. Exactly, that's it. That's the information. Yeah. Go to A&E. But there's nowhere for people to go because the few mental hospitals are already full.
Anyway, it is now, we've come up to 12 noon and we are going to the newsroom and Sharon Tobin.